I'm speaking today with Dr. Diana Eck, who is Professor of Comparative Religion and Indian Studies in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and member of the Faculty of Divinity at Harvard University. Diana Eck's academic work has a dual focus, India and America. And in both cases, she is interested in the challenges of religious pluralism in a multi-religious society. Since 1991, she has headed the Pluralism Project, which explores and interprets the religious dimensions of America's new immigration, the growth of Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, Jain, and Zoroastrian communities in the United States, and the new issues of religious pluralism and American civil society. Diana, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Wonderful, Lois. It's good to be here.
Tell us more about the Pluralism Project and what its focus is.
Well, the Pluralism Project really grew out of my own teaching at Harvard. I am a professor of comparative religion, as you say. I've done a lot of work in India, and India is a multi-religious nation, to be sure. But along about 1990, I started having in my own classes, whether on India or just introductions to religion, a lot of students who were of Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist background, and who had not come to Harvard from abroad, but who had grown up in the United States. And I began to realize that I didn't know very much about the religious dimensions of America's new immigration. And that was really when the Pluralism Project started. I realized I taught about Hindus in India, but I didn't know much about Hindus in Boston or any other place in the U.S. I taught about Muslims, but didn't know about the Islamic communities of my own city. So that became the focus of my research, and I realized there were not very many people who were doing this kind of research. It had kind of stolen up on us, and suddenly we were surprised that we in America have become a much more multi-religious we.
And I think you mentioned somewhere in the materials from the Religious Pluralism Project that a lot of this religious pluralism really began with, what was it, the Immigration Act of 1965? Can you talk a little bit more about that and how that affected this sort of influx of different religious traditions in this country?
Yes, I think it's important to remember that the new immigration laws passed in the mid-60s, in 1965, the Immigration and Nationalities Act, were also passed kind of in tandem with the Civil Rights Act, with the Voting Rights Act, those that came in 1964, 1965. This was a period in which, as Robert Kennedy, who in the early 60s was our Attorney General, said, we can't be trying to eliminate race discrimination in every aspect of our legal life in the United States and still have it as the cornerstone of our immigration policy. And indeed it was. I mean, we had an immigration policy that was basically tilted toward the populations that were already here from Europe and fairly restrictive about people from elsewhere in the world. Now, why should that be? So it was a much more open-door immigration policy. I don't think anyone at the time imagined how much it would change the United States, but it really has. That means we have immigrants from all over Asia. I look especially at those from South Asia, from India and Pakistan, Bangladesh. And then, of course, you have to remember this was also the time that we were emerging in the early 70s from the war in Vietnam. And we had a lot of refugees who came really because of our war there, came from Cambodia and from the camps in Thailand and from Vietnam. So that was another population that came to the U.S. And then, of course, we've always had immigration from Latin America. So this has made America a really complex society, racially, ethnically, culturally, and religiously. And it's really the religious dimensions of that that I set out to research.
What have been sort of the patterns, trends you've seen then in your research in terms of those immigration patterns since the 60s?
Well, to some extent, one could see some of the kinds of immigration patterns that had been observed early on. A first generation of immigrants that that basically brought with them much of the language and culture of the old country, wherever that might be. A second generation that rebelled against that and wanted to be truly American, whatever that means. And a third generation that then discovers the roots of their ancestors and cares much more about them. That pattern, which actually a number of sociologists pointed to in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s, is slightly different now, because in those days, by 1924, we actually closed the doors of immigration. So we didn't have a lot of fresh immigrants coming. Now we still have a number of people coming every year as immigrants. And that does sort of change the alteration of the generations.
So just, I want to go back a minute because people might not know this. So prior to 1924, we were mostly getting folks from Western Europe. And so it was primarily Christianity, Judaism, maybe a few people who were Islamic, but not huge numbers.
That's true.
And then so we closed our doors in 1924, and we must have opened them then again, late 30s, early 40s with World War II?
We did after World War II, a little more immigration. But still, and some immigration from some of the China, for example, that had been one of our allies, so to speak. But still, it was just a trickle, really. So we didn't have a lot of new immigrants during this time. It was possible, but it was still a small percentage of the quota percentage of those who were already here. And I think what we're seeing now, we do have some older communities. For example, you mentioned Muslims. There were Muslims who came in the late 19th century with the immigrants who were allowed to come from the area we call Jordan, Syria, Palestine then. And some of them were Muslim and some of them were Christian. But some of the very, very oldest Muslim communities in the U.S. really did grow up in that era. Interestingly, the oldest purpose-built mosque in the United States was in Ross, North Dakota, of all things, because a lot of the immigrants who came needed something to do. Many of them became pack peddlers, and in the Midwest, there were lots and lots of places that didn't have access to regular stores, so they would go out with their packs and horses and eventually little cars and sell all sorts of notions. They were like a traveling Woolworths. And so there was another very small but important community in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In fact, the mother mosque of America, they say, really is in Cedar Rapids. It still exists today. So these were very small communities, but they did exist. And the same you could say in a general way with some of the very early Chinese communities that came when the Chinese came during the gold rush. We had them in Montana. We had lots of Chinese up and down the West Coast, and they built the railroads across the continent. But they were not allowed to own land, not allowed to become citizens, etc. And yet some of them did stay. And so we have among the very oldest Chinese Buddhist / Confucian temples in the U.S. are those in Chinatown in San Francisco and a few others in California. So there are some of these communities that go back to an older generation. But it really is only after 1965 that we begin to get quite a lot of Buddhist communities, really from all over Asia, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, a number of Islamic communities, Hindu communities, in ways that are actually increasingly visible in American cities and towns.
How much did sort of that fascination with those who were disenfranchised in the 60s, the sort of Euro-American white bred folks, the hippies who went to India and other places and to become enlightened, how much did that then influence another wave of immigration of Eastern ideas? I'm not going to say Hinduism because I don't think it was just Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Did you see, was that a large?
That's also another important piece of this, I think, that it's not just that people came to the U.S., but ideas flowing back and forth as well. And one of the things that happened in 1965 in that opening of the doors was that for the first time, in a long time, we had a significant number of religious teachers who came from Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, India, and they were, you know, I mean, we saw it in the 60s and 70s, the gurus, the Swami Bhaktivedanta, who started the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the Hare Krishnas in the U.S., and some of the great Zen teachers like Meizumi Roshi, who came across the Pacific and became one of the founding teachers of the Zen Center of Los Angeles, and who became the founding initiator of a generation of American-born Euro-American Zen masters who exist today. So there, the teachers came as people to this country, but with them came some of the traditions, ideas, practices, and ethos, really, that is represented by some of the Asian traditions.
Well, then my question is, how much does the essence of these traditions shift when they're introduced into a new culture? I know Charlotte Jokobek, I had the opportunity to meet her. My former partner was one of her students, and she's really credited with sort of westernizing Zen Buddhism,
making it
something that we can tolerate and as Americans. But how much does that shift the core, let's say, of Zen Buddhism? How much are we shifting these traditions when we introduce them into a new culture?
Well, this is an age-old question, really. I mean, especially in the case of Buddhism, which you could say has a kind of essence. I mean, there are foundational teachings and practices. But really, the Buddhist tradition moved from India to Central Asia to China. It developed new ways of being in China and also in Korea and Japan, new languages in which it was expressed, new forms of meditation practice. I mean, no one in India ever did sword practice or the sort of thing that they developed in Japan. And the development of the arts in relation to Zen in Japan was really significant. But I think we expect to see the same thing with the Buddhist tradition in a new culture, because it is not a tradition that's defined by culture, but rather by what Buddhists would see as the deepest dimensions of our humanity and the kinds of insights that are important to waking up those of us, and that's all of us really, who are somewhat asleep spiritually most of the time. So someone like Charlotte Jokobek is actually, you might say, a genuine interpreter of the Buddhist tradition in America. She was a student of Meizumi Roshi mm-hmm. at ZCLA, at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And there were others like Bernie Glassman, who Roshi Bernie became, someone who started nonprofits in New York, a sort of combination of for-profit and nonprofit movements out of the Zen Center of New York. A bakery that employed the homeless, etc. Distinctive ways of being Buddhist. He would have Zen retreats on the streets of New York with the homeless. So these are ways of enculturating the Buddhist tradition in the U.S. that I would say are really quite genuine and quite deep and quite natural for the long history of Buddhism.
You know, I'm wondering how that, if that same kind of translation or interpretation has happened with Islam in this country. I mean, because we have such a different culture here. And I'm wondering how those two have interacted, especially when it comes to gender roles or other norms, for instance, in this country that are absolutely antithetical to Islam. What are you seeing?
Well, this is a very interesting question. I mean, let me go back to the first part of the question you asked before, is how do they become different? Well, one of the things that happens in the U.S. is that we define our religious communities as nonprofits, basically 501c3s. And in order to be that, you have to have officers, you have to have elections, you have to have all of the things that are sort of the foundation stones of American democracy in some ways. And that's always been the case. That was the case for the Swedish Lutherans when they came. They had to develop a way of being religious that was voluntaristic. And that's distinctively American. It does mean that we have a kind of institutionalization that means communities have to develop an infrastructure that looks like an American nonprofit. And nobody is going to build their mosque for them unless they raise the money themselves or raise it from charitable donations, whether from abroad or from here. And, you know, pretty soon they're developing newsletters and email lists and websites and all of this stuff as well. So there is a kind of Americanization that happens across the board in that respect. As for Islam, that too is a religious tradition that has so many different textures in different parts of the world, in Indonesia and Malaysia, or very different from what one might see in Egypt or Tunisia and France and the UK. I mean, there are a lot of cultural forms, but there is really a core to Islamic faith that is focused on the shahada, the affirmation, the witness that there's no God but God and Muhammad is God's messenger, and the practice of prayer and of fasting during Ramadan, the things that are called the five pillars of Islam. And those are fairly consistent across the board, although there are some Shiite Islamic movements that don't practice them in quite the same way. In the U.S., understandably, there is a tendency toward a much more what some people would call progressive form of Islam that is very much attuned with American values, that is affirmative of democracy, for example. I mean, many Muslims will say, you know, the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, these have very deep Islamic roots for us. We recognize ourselves in those documents of individual dignity and equality, that sort of thing. And so they see Islam as resonant with America. And then there are forms of expression that are much more in tune with, you might say, contemporary American values. Many more women scholars of Islam who are trained in our universities. The first women-led mixed Muslim prayer was led by Amina Wadud, who is an American-born African-American Muslim. Grew up as a Methodist, I think, but a very fine Quranic scholar. And, of course, we know in the Muslim tradition that the person who leads the community in prayer is the imam and is the educated person, not a cleric in the way we ordinarily think of it. So there is women's leadership. There are lots of sort of socially progressive service projects. There are groups like the Muslim Public Affairs Council that attempt to bring Muslim voices to bear on political issues, including the environment and Copenhagen and politics in Washington and issues of Guantanamo. I mean, they have a voice in those issues. And that, again, is a very American participatory thing. There's even a queer jihad network in the United States that that enables gay and lesbian Muslims to be in some communication where they, you know, are not really necessarily above ground in their local Islamic settings. So I think there's a lot going on. I don't think that one thinks about Islam in a kind of monolithic way in the U.S. just as in any other part of the world. And certainly there are very conservative voices as well as very progressive ones.
Well, this brings me to another question, which is, I've been thinking a lot about this because there are a lot of us who are considered liberal, and we just want these conservative voices out of our political arena, yet we're very happy to inject our liberal voices into the arena. Or I guess I should say the only voice we want injected is the liberal voice. So what should the role of religion be in the public and political arenas here in the States?
Well, I think that people of religious faith ought to have a voice on the big issues of the day, because it's not as if the big issues of the day are not value-laden. They are very important issues. And if our religion isn't about those, I don't know what it's about. But I think it's very important also when people of faith speak in the public sphere that to recognize that they are speaking to and in the context of a multi-religious democracy. This is not a country that Christians alone or any one religious community alone can or should be in charge of. This is, you know, if someone is running for public office in the United States of America, it needs to be very clear that the language he or she uses is language that indicates that he or she is running to be an officer and an elected official of all the people, not just of the people of their own religious persuasion. So there needs to be a kind of public rhetoric, I don't care whether you're conservative or liberal, Christian or Muslim or whatever, that indicates in the way we speak publicly that though this is my deepest conviction, I recognize that the land in which I am participating as a public official is one that respects the deepest convictions of others, even those whom I disagree with. And that is the way the American Constitution works. That's why we have a Supreme Court. That's why we have our courts in general, because they are the body that protects the rights and dignity of people who don't win elections. And if it were only by majority rule, then majorities could run rampant over everybody. But thank God it's not that way, by design. So I think it is important that people speak their value politics publicly, but do so in a way that is American when they're speaking in a public context in America. So if I'm talking about something as a Christian, I'm going to say, as a Christian, in fact, as a lifelong Methodist, I'd like to say this, but I recognize that there are people out there who will disagree with me. And these are the very people I would like to persuade. And I think as Americans, we don't base our final decisions on what Methodists believe, but on what the Constitution says. And I think we need to develop the kind of nuance of having a religious voice, a public voice, a voice of faith, a voice of citizenship that we recognize are different. I mean, if I'm giving a talk on religious pluralism at the United Methodist Church in Bozeman, I'm going to use different kinds of references. I'm going to refer to the Bible and talk about the way in which we should treat strangers and neighbors and the importance of relationship. I would talk that kind of gospel language, really, because that comes out of the gospel, I think, that Jesus taught. If I'm talking in a public group, I'm not going to base my references on the Bible. I'm going to talk about the Constitution and the things we share in common and the covenants of citizenship. And if I'm talking as a scholar, I'm likely to talk about religious pluralism that brings in the voices of a lot of people, because that's what scholarship is about, creating those conversations that make us think about what really matters. But, you know, we need to have all of those voices because we are multivocal people.
Well, that brings me to another question, which is, and I know you've talked a lot about this, but what is the difference between diversity, plurality, and pluralism?
Well, diversity is just a fact. That's a fact of our existence, of our life. We know if we look around our community, even a community that seems to be fairly homogeneous, and we see that people are different. And cultures are different. And now in America, there's a lot of difference. There's virtually not a major city of any size in the United States that does not have a large or small Muslim population, maybe some Hindus, a lot of Hindu doctors if you go into the hospitals. And so diversity is who we are. And we can recognize it, we can celebrate it on some celebratory day or something like that, or we can really resist it and say, I don't like this, I like how it was before. But diversity is just, I would say, a neutral description of the fact of difference. Pluralism is really what we make out of that. It's an engagement with that diversity that enables us to create a society that includes not just people who are like me, but people who are different from me. And that takes some work. It takes some energy. It means you have to participate. It means you have to maybe get to know something about the people who are different from you. Maybe meet them. Find out they're not so scary after all. Or maybe you really do disagree with them, and that's okay too. But it is a quality of engagement, I think, that is really important in a society of diversity.
Thank you for that answer. I think that was a really important distinction for many of us. I especially appreciate you saying that diversity is a fact.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that. What we choose to do with that is up to us. What are the challenges of religious pluralism in a multi-religious society?
Well, they come down to different kinds of challenges as well. I mean, let me talk religiously at the beginning. If I'm speaking as a Christian, talking to other people who are Christians, one of the challenges of religious diversity or religious pluralism as well is to think about my own faith in the light of the fact that there are obviously people of faith who have a deep faith, who pray perhaps more often than I do, who do not hold the same religious world, whose world of life and death and meaning is framed by another religious tradition, whether it's Muslim or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist. So what does that mean for my own faith? How do I think about myself as a Christian in relationship to other people of faith? How do I reach out to know them? What might I actually learn from them, both about myself and about the one I call God? I mean, those are really important religious questions. No one can ignore them unless you just stick your head in the sand these days. People think that the whole sum total of everything that is said about this question in the Bible is written on a little piece of paper that says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and there's no other way to the Father but through me." That quote from the Gospel of John, it is one line. Please, it occurs in the same chapter that talks about the many mansions and the many rooms in my Father's house, or the many sheep that are not of this fold. But we manage to pluck those things out and cling to them as if that truth was the only thing that occurred there. We don't even know what it means. We don't even know, for the most part, what question that was an answer to. So I think that religious diversity and the impetus to pluralism really poses deep questions to people of every faith. How do we think about God? How do we think about ourselves as human beings in this world of diversity?
Have you seen many interfaith associations around the country?
I've seen lots of them, and it's one of the things the Pluralism Project studies, actually, is how they grow, the different kinds of interfaith associations, and what are some of the challenges they've been involved in.
What are some of those challenges that you've seen from the studies that the Pluralism Project has done?
Well, a lot of those we can place in the civic sphere, for example, in how it affects us as citizens. I give you an example from Troy, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, which has long had a National Day of Prayer. And the National Day of Prayer occurs early in May, has over the last number of years basically been hijacked by a group that calls itself the National Day of Prayer Coalition or something from Colorado Springs, and is basically related to Focus on the Family. And so they had been having their National Day of Prayer for many years in Troy, Michigan, on the steps of City Hall, but it really was a National Christian and Conservative Christian Day of Prayer at that. And one year, a woman, Padma Kupa, who is a Hindu from Troy, Michigan, said, well, you know, she'd kind of like to participate in that and offer a prayer from the Hindu tradition. And so she was told, well, we've already fixed our program for this year. Sorry, you can't. So Padma was still interested, so she called the mayor, who was going to launch the day of prayer that day. And the mayor said, oh, no, it'd be great to have you participate. You can have some of my time when I introduce the day of prayer and welcome everyone. Now, I tell you, the mayor didn't even know that the National Day of Prayer had become this exclusive Christian thing in Troy, Michigan. This is, the way in which these issues happen are not always clear to people, especially to public officials who may not be so sophisticated about things. And so she came to the microphone on the city hall steps with the crowd down below and welcomed everyone and turned the mic over to Padma Kupa, who gave a Hindu prayer for the first time ever at this event. And people were blown away. They were so upset that there should be a Hindu praying at the National Day of Prayer. Well, this isn't about political correctness. This isn't about anybody praying. This is about prayer, they kept saying. And that really became the genesis of the Interfaith Coalition. I'm telling that long story because that is one of the ways in which an interfaith group gets together and decides, no, this isn't right. And we're going to have an interfaith day of prayer that really does represent in our civic space the things that all of us hold and cherish as Americans. So some interfaith groups get started that way. Some get started by being basically councils of churches that eventually become councils of Christians and Jews, and then there maybe is a Muslim, they invite them, and gradually they develop. Some of them are leadership councils that are largely composed of clergy, and that's good, but that becomes a problem. Some of them are very populist. Anyone who is really interested in interfaith comes together and joins. Some of them are focused on civic issues. Like the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization works on housing and health care and those issues. So they're as varied as our religious communities are.
Do you think they're more successful if they have an external focus in the sense of not just being about let's get to know each other, which I think is very, very important part of what we do in interfaith groups and conversation, that we have some sense of the other so we can build trust. Do you think they're more successful if they are turnout, or if they do things like work on housing, if they take on whatever issue it is that's coming up in their community?
They can be successful either way. I mean, sometimes the things that come up really are about, I don't know these other people and I'm a little bit apprehensive about who they are. So I do need to get to know them. And that's important. But, you know, you also do get to know each other when you do things together. I mean, there's a very successful interfaith group in Central Ohio that builds habitat houses together. They've not only done it in Ohio, they've gone and done it in Jordan. They've, you know, developed a way of working together with hammers and nails that also sort of feeds their relationship building. And so, but I think eventually people who talk about their own faith do come to the point where the things they talk about do have to do with their social environment. What can we do together? And those are important issues.
One of the things that amazed me about Bozeman was that it had a very active Gallatin Valley Interfaith Association that truly had, I mean, it was ecumenical, but it was also interfaith. I was so struck by this because I hadn't seen this in other places. I mean, that we had folks from very different backgrounds sitting down with one another, committed to getting to know one another. And we've gotten so far. And then I start hearing things like, we can't get political. How do you respond to that? Because what I've said is the most political radical person that I happen to know from my own background was the person of Jesus, mm-hmm. and what he modeled, mm-hmm. which was incarnate, you know, hospitality and being the most radical, you know, parabler, all of that good stuff. What do you say to folks who say, well, we can't be political?
Well, it's a difficult question because I think there are certain issues. You can get political as long as your commitment is to relationship with each other. Because it's clear on some political issues, I mean, the most obvious ones, issues of abortion, for example, a lot of people are not going to agree. And they might get really very exercised about some of these issues. And that's okay, as long as that's not what everyone is trying to do together, because if your commitment is not to agree on everything, but to be in relationship with each other, then you have a different basis for who you are. And then I think you can talk about a lot of things. The projects that you undertake as an interfaith group might need to involve people who, you know, a broader consensus of people. But it is true. There is a lot that is political. Economics is political. Consumerism is political. War and peace is political. All of these are really important issues that religious people care about.
And go to war over,
yeah. And gay issues. I mean, this is very hard in an interfaith context because you really are treading on people's deepest sense of gender identity and that sort of thing. So you're never going to get very many in a wide spectrum of interfaith groups to say, oh, yes, we're all behind and we're going to participate in the gay rights day together or something like that. It's probably not what's going to happen. It is a place, however, where people who are Muslims and never thought they knew any gay people are very interested to meet that the you know, people across the table actually are gay. I mean, then you get some of that face-to-face meeting that is so important for breaking down the stereotypes and barriers.
And if we can't stand together necessarily on gay issues, maybe we can stand together on issues of HIV and AIDS and come together
Probably.
To celebrate, you know, the World AIDS Day observance.
I think so.
As opposed to going to a gay pride event as
sure.
an interfaith association. I'm speaking with Dr. Diana Eck, who is a professor of comparative religion and Indian studies in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and a member of the Faculty of Divinity at Harvard University. And once again, Diana, thank you for taking the time to talk with me and whoever gets to hear this here in Bozeman and across the country.
Thank you, Lois.
One of the things I'm curious about is when we are trying to step into, quote, alien territory, meet each other in the borderlands, is the language that I'm borrowing from somebody. Sometimes we talk about having to find common ground as the first thing that we can do, since we're so far apart on so many issues. Is that what's going to get us to understand each other, trying to find common ground, or is it really going to be understanding that other, that person, that culture, that religious tradition that's other?
Well, I think both are important. I mean, that's I think not an evasive way to respond, but I think that's really true, that pluralism is really based on the fact that we're different. And yet we do stand on common ground, whether it's the common ground of being citizens of the United States or the common ground of being residents of Bozeman or the common ground of affirming that we believe in one God, which some of our faiths do, or the common ground that we care deeply about certain issues. I mean, the issues of personal spirituality or of public good. So, but we begin by the fact that we really are different. We're different just as two different people, and we're different as people who come out of different religious communities. So I don't think that common ground is the only thing. I think the dialogue that we develop, the form of discourse that we develop that involves listening and speaking and learning more and more, that yields common ground eventually. But you don't necessarily start with common ground because we don't even know where it is. And I think that there are many initiatives these days that reach for common ground or common vision, and those are important. But some of the things on which we differ are also important. And sometimes the most important thing we have in common is a clear understanding of how we're different.
You know, I want to talk about a different kind of ground that you used in your lecture at the Goddard 2000 at Oregon State University. And you talked about knowing when you're standing on holy ground. And I believe you even said taking off your shoes when you have that knowledge. Can you talk a little bit more about what it means to be standing on holy ground and how to recognize that?
That's
not just one's own.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I took that phrase actually from a wonderful man who was a Christian missionary and educator in India and the head of Madras Christian College during a good bit of the middle part of the 20th century. And like many people, he himself not only expanded his own sense of faith, his name was A.G. Hogg, H-O-G-G, but he also discovered in some of his students the depths of their faith. And the person on whom about whom he was talking there was a young man named Radhakrishnan, who was a student at Madras Christian College, who eventually became a distinguished philosopher, the Spalding Professor of Eastern Traditions at Oxford, and eventually became one of the first presidents of India. And he said of him, "Is there such a thing as a faith that embraces all of us, faith, that sort of affective sense of belonging to the one we call God, but a faith that is not exclusive to our own tradition, but in the light of which we recognize that in someone else's, in observing and participating and joining someone else in their faith, that we are standing on the holy ground of a commerce between the human and the divine that makes us want to take off the shoes of our feet." And that really struck me, because I do feel that when I visit Hindus, maybe in their own home or in a Hindu temple, or become a participant, even a not very good one, in a Buddhist meditation context, and listen to the instruction and deepening perception of a teacher, this is holy ground. And I think those of us who have experienced it in our own tradition, in worship or in prayer, recognize this in the faith of others, and sometimes are able to participate in it. I mean, I feel this very often as I have attended Muslim prayers, communal prayers. And I'm sitting with the women. I don't want to just be sitting on a chair. I'm not very good at the prayer postures, but why would I not pray with them? That is holy ground, the ground of their prayer. And the prayers that they speak and utter are not necessarily ones I even understand, because most of the prayer language is in Arabic and I don't understand Arabic, but I understand the impetus to pray. And that is holy ground, and it's not ground that just belongs to us. You know, I mean, this is what we might call God's ground, if we want to use that word.
You know, you've been talking about the fact that since the 60s, we're seeing this huge influx of pluralism in this country. There's also something else that's going on that you might be aware of. There's a book by Bill Bishop called The Big Sort. You know that one?
I don't know it. Tell me about it.
His main premise is that people are going and seeking out and trying to live in more and more homogeneous communities. And what that's doing is actually removing us from the possibility of interaction with those who we consider to be other, so that what is truth, what we seek, is all narrow. So we only would listen to this kind of radio station. We would only read these kind of papers. We would only live in these kind of communities. And we seek them out, as opposed to recognizing the fact that we are diverse. So it seems like there's almost two things happening here.
That's scary in some ways, but you know, and I recognize from what you're saying that there's probably some truth in that. We know that people tend to seek out the folks who are like them. You mentioned radio stations. I think that's probably true. I mean, I don't tend to listen to radio stations that have people on them that I find just offensive to listen to. So I tune in public radio or something like that. So maybe it has some truth in it. But, you know, in the kind of world we live in today, all I can say is, if that's your thesis, that we're sorting ourselves into homogeneous communities, good luck, because that's not the world. I mean, the world is ever more suffused with the diversity of entertainment, of news, of people, of folks in the workplace, of folks at school, of the roommates, of the kids you send to college. You're never going to be able to recreate those sort of isolated communities. And if you can recreate one for a while, you can bet your life that your kids aren't going to live there. So I just don't see it in the world of globalization and the expansion of information systems as a possibility for the future. But it's an interesting thesis, and I want to read that book.
Oh, it's fascinating. Is there a downside to pluralism, do you think? Has there been a downside to religious pluralism in America, for instance?
Well, I'm trying to think about that, because there must be. And I think for some people, there is the sense that, well, if all of these traditions have some real value in them, maybe mine doesn't matter to me as much. I mean, any attempt to sort of anything that makes us loosen our hold on the taproot of our own tradition might be hard for families and for, you know, communities. I think it inevitably happens, but it does mean that people feel that their own particular family, religious, etc. life is not as vibrant as they once thought it was, because it was shared with everyone, you know. And I don't feel that myself. I mean, I certainly feel that I feel more attuned to Christian worship now because I know it in the context of the ways in which lots of people worship. It's my family, my community. And, you know, I'm not always looking out to see whether someone else's family is better or, you know, that sort of thing. I feel that, you know, there is a sense of belonging that is really important, and community matters. So any extent to which pluralism loosens our sense of community may feel really threatening to a lot of people. It does create new communities, though, and that's an important piece.
I think those new communities you're talking about are the communities that, for instance, my nieces and nephews and my grandchild are going to be living into.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rebecca Parker, who is the president of Starr King School for Religion, gave a lecture to the LAREDA group, which is a Liberal Religious Educators Association, several years ago. And she said, you know, we always like to talk about, well, there's one truth, but we're all going up the mountain on different paths trying to reach this one truth. And she posed the question, what if we're climbing different mountains? People are always after the truth of my tradition, the truth of this tradition. How do we sit at the table with all these truths? I mean, is there a truth, or what do we do about honoring these?
Well, that's a really tough question, because I think there are many, many truths, really. And that, who knows? We know there are many mountains, and that is for sure. And that maybe all of our paths are headed in the same way. We do know that all of our paths have some things in common. And we do know that all of our paths have some really dangerous pitfalls that might lead us to, you know, fall into deep crevasses as well. You know, I'm not really sure about this, but I do think that truth is not something that we can postulate in advance, really. We have ideas of the way in which we live the things that we believe to be true. But here I really take a page from Gandhi, who felt that truth was something that you hold in a kind of open-handed way and invite others to see it as you do, if they can glimpse it, but not something you sort of hold in your closed and clenched fist as if you owned it. And that it's only in that mutual seeking that we discover truth. And the other thing I would say is that truth is really, it has to do with, it's a personal quality as much as anything. And what is really true for me today might not be true for me in 10 years. Not intellectually, but as, you know, the way in which we speak of true north, as that by which we set our compass. And that's a way of living, not some sort of abstract affirmation.
Well, Diana, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. I've been speaking with Dr. Diana Echt, who is professor at Harvard University, both at the Divinity School and at the university. This has been very enlightening for me personally. Thank you again for taking the time.
And thank you, Lois. Here we are in the common ground of Bozeman, and it's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.